If you think you can't go from politics to the divine, Carol Gold and Steve Clark are about to take you above the fray. The only agenda here is to empower you to think for yourself, ask more questions, and trust your own truth. So now, the combination talk radio has been missing. Until now, Carol Gold and Steve Clark taking you above the fray.
Hi, welcome. I'm Carol Gold. I'm here with my co-host Steve Clark. The call-in number, 914-803-4522, if you want to join in the conversation, and of course, the chat room. We have a great topic tonight and a special guest that's going to help us along with that topic. We want to talk about police brutality and police excessive force, and the reason I want to talk about it is because something happened in Kansas in the last few days which should be of interest to all of us. And what it is that a woman who formerly lived in Denver, Colorado, moved to Kansas with her son. She had she has Crohn's disease and had medical prescription for using cannabis. And she, in fact, used cannabis oil. She didn't smoke marijuana. She used the cannabis oil to help treat with the pain and the discomfort of Crohn's. Her son in the new school in Kansas was on a debate team, pro and con, whether marijuana should be legalized. And he chose to be on the pro side, and he argued pro legalization for medical reasons. His teacher went ahead and reported him to the principal, concerned that based on his argument, there might be drugs in his home. The school called the police department, Department of whatever it's called in the state of Colorado, state of Kansas, Department of Children and Youth Services, showed up with the police at the mother's home. She was unaware of what had happened with the child in school. When she answered the door, they asked her to come out onto the front porch. They kept her in front of her house for 3 hours, not permitting her to return to her home, regardless of the fact that she was asking why was she being questioned, why was she being held out on the porch. They told her they believed that they had reason to be concerned for the safety of children in her home and that there might be drugs. She said no to both. 3 hours later, someone showed up with a warrant. They completely searched her home, every corner, every drawer, and what they found was 2 ounces of cannabis oil for which she had a prescription. That's not the end or the worst part of the story. They've taken her son away from her, given him temporary full custody to her ex-husband, who only previously had visitation, and she is now facing charges that could remove her child from her as the primary caretaker permanently. There are, in the last few years on average, 80,000 incidents a year nationwide where the police are ignoring the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution and breaking into people's homes, violating personal property rights, all under the guise of what clearly under law does not rise to the level of probable cause. Probable cause being the ability to show a judge sufficient facts or evidence to warrant the issue. I'm using a double word here, legally and non-legally, to warrant the issuance of a warrant in order to search a premises. So, Steve, what I'd like to do is have our guest come on and join the conversation. We have for you tonight Shelley Albert. Shelley is an attorney in New York and New Jersey. She is a former assistant district attorney for the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. Shelley left the office after 5 years, where she tried over 100 cases to verdict. In private practice ever since, she is a frequent guest on CNBC, MSNBC, Fox News, The Sean Hannity Show. Shelley is known as a well-credentialed and successful attorney in her field, practicing both criminal defense law and family law. Shelley, welcome to the show.
Hello, Carol. Hello, Steve. How are you?
Great,
Steve,
thanks.
Good. We have a delay. Okay. Shelley, can you talk to me a little bit about what's been your experience, either in the Manhattan office or since, with this expansion or excessive police activity where clearly there's a Fourth Amendment issue that ought to precede their ability to go into people's homes or into onto private property?
Well, clearly there's a Fourth Amendment issue here, but the other issue that I see, if I look at it from the standpoint of the police and I look at it from the standpoint of law enforcement, the issue from what would be a justifiable invasion into the home, and this is nothing short of an invasion into the home, let alone what the consequences were based on the facts before us, but what they have is they have a real live, legitimate type person. Presumably the complaint came from the school teacher or the principal or somebody else from the school who said, based on what this child had stated in the school, that there was potentially drugs in that home. Now, I don't know about the particular law, if cannabis is legal in the particular area where this woman was living in Kansas. She might have had a prescription from another state. But beyond that, the police would certainly consider this a justifiable invasion into this woman's home. They asked her to leave their home. They asked her to leave her home, rather. They would look at this as this was a voluntary consent to enter. This is the issue, and this is what the first line of defense is and the first problem that we have, is it would be very easy for us from these cheap seats, so to speak, to say, well, the woman could have said, I'm not leaving my home. I'm calling my lawyer. Get off of my lawn. And what would have been the next step on from the part of law enforcement? And from the part of law enforcement, they might have looked at it as a reasonable probability to believe that they have a right to secure that premises to prevent her from getting rid of the drugs that were potentially in the home while they secure a warrant. They did indeed secure the warrant. They did indeed secure the location before they got the warrant. So even if she spoke up and said, I have a Fourth Amendment right, and even if she spoke up and she said, I'm calling my lawyer, and even if she spoke up and called 911 or did whatever she could have done, there's no way this woman, from a practical standpoint, could have prevented the invasion into her home, because of the way that we look at it in practice. And that's the issue. And that's a very, very difficult issue to face, because the complaint, the initial reason or the initial observation or whatever we want to call it, the initial reason that alerted the police did not come from the standpoint of kids. It came from the standpoint of a school teacher or somebody in school administration. And that's the problem that I see, let alone all the consequences that happen. But when you're that woman on the street and you've got the knock on the door and you've got the entire law enforcement body or the perception of the government coming down on you, you're not going to say no. Even if you do, you're in trouble.
Steve, I don't know if you have anything you want to say to that, and I'll certainly give you an opportunity. I first would like to ask Shelley as a follow-up. Shelley, as you said, it didn't come from a kid. It came from a school official at some level. Is it sufficient to be able to, based on something a kid says in a classroom, he didn't come in beaten up, he didn't come in abused, he's not complaining of anything, he's doing what his teacher asked him to do, which is take a pro argument for the legalization of marijuana, is whatever he says about, well, you know, people may need it medically, my mom needs it medically, and let's say marijuana is not legal in Kansas, I don't even know, is that sufficient to basically trigger what followed from that? Was there probable cause when the principal or the teacher called Department of Children and Family Services?
Carol, that's an excellent point. And the reason why that's an excellent point is because every state interprets the observation of probable cause and required for probable cause differently. For example, the two main tests that we have across the country are, do we look at the totality of the circumstances or do we separate these two things? Was the initial probable cause from a certified, so to speak, or a legitimate source? Who's the source of the probable cause? Is it somebody that the police know is a liar or know is a, not necessarily in full mental faculties, or somebody that's made false complaints in the past? Or is it from a legitimate so-called source, and then we look at what the actual information is? So it's either the one-prong test generally, which is the totality of the circumstances. We look at all of the circumstances, and I can give you an example of what I mean. Or is it the so-called two-prong test, where we look at where the source of the information is, who gave us the source of the information? Was it an anonymous source? Was it a 911 call that there's a gun in that house and we have no idea? And then we have to look at exactly what the circumstances are. Now, those two prongs come in, if, again, every state is different. The totality of the circumstances test can look at if I'm on the street and I'm a police officer and I got a call from a robbery in progress and I go to a scene and I see two men or one man or whatever fitting the description running into a house, do I have the right to follow those men in under the totality of the circumstances? Again, where did that source, if we look at the totality, I as a police officer have the call, I have the information, I have somebody fitting the description, I might follow those men or that man into that house and be completely justified in my entry into that home. If we look at it from the two-prong test, if my source of that information was an anonymous 911 call, and I'm in a, you know, now I have to look at what the information was. Was it a robbery in progress, or was it two men fleeing from a car? Was this car stolen? We really leave a lot to the discretion of the police officers on the street as to when they can make that invasion. And just so we're clear, we're not just talking about, because most of us think in our heads, well, if a police officer, you know, hears this as there's two men fleeing the scene and they're, you know, two black sweatshirts and blue jeans and white sneakers, and then the cop comes on the scene and sees that, maybe it's two guys jogging and I'm angry at my neighbor, so I'm going to call it in. And that's why we have these protections out there. Or that's why we have to look at all the circumstances, because if the police see my son or my husband or my brother or somebody coming into my house, the last thing I want is, because my neighbor is angry at me, now all of a sudden I have police busting through my door, throwing me on the ground, searching through all my property, saying, where's the guns? Where's the guns? Where's the stolen property? Making me lie with my face on the floor for 3 hours while they secure a warrant if I insist that that be done. Those are the types of invasions. And again, I want to be very clear about this. That's what happens in real life. This isn't stuff out of a movie. This is truly what happens in neighborhoods every single day. Carol earlier had brought up a statistic of approximately 80,000 every day, potentially. I know this
every year.
80,000 times a year this is going on. Real life in America, where I'm sitting home watching TV, I've got my feet up, I'm in my pajamas, however I am, and the police are literally knocking down doors and rushing in on what may or may not be good probable cause. I want to raise one more issue if I can, and that has to do with the source of the information. Is it good enough if it came from a kid? Well, in the context of this particular case, it could potentially be good enough if it came for a kid. We don't know what that particular boy said when he was in the class. We're not privy to that information. I'm sure we'll find out as this case progresses. But what about if the kid was asked to give a lecture on pro and con, on being able to demonstrate against the president? Or what if this kid was asked to give a lecture about pro and con on gun control, or having guns, or having assault weapons? I mean, it could really be carried out to the umpth degree as to when we're going to say that it was inappropriate for the teacher to do what the teacher did in this particular case, and yet the teacher is completely immune from anything because the police acted based on that.
Steve, I want you to get in here because you're at a little bit of a disadvantage. You've got me, a former practicing family lawyer, and you've got a currently practicing lawyer, and we're both women, and we could take up the 30 minutes in and of ourselves without letting you get a word in. So before I turn this over and let you either comment or ask what you want to ask of Shelley, the number here is 914-803-4522 if you want to get into this discussion and if you want to ask a question or make a comment to our highly experienced guest today, Shelley Albert, attorney formerly from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and currently in private practice in New Jersey and New York. Steve?
Yeah, just one point that maybe either of you could answer. Phyllis Shapley's kind of written about this over the last 10 years about what's happening regarding things like this. I refer to something like restraining orders, child protective services, welfare cases, where she argues that the local states and governments have an economic incentive to put people into this pipeline. So meaning that the way that the incentives are now set up, the one case I'll give you is restraining orders, that there's an incentive there for the states to issue more restraining orders. More restraining orders that get issued the more the federal government will match the funds for the social services involved in those cases. And so what she has argued over the years is that what we've seen is an increase in policing, especially in terms of like an incident today, something that gets involved with the Child Protective Services or social services. There's a weird economic incentive to have more of those cases because at the end the federal government will match those monies and give them more money for more policing on those cases, and hence we get more cases like this, and the police have a weird economic incentive to pursue more of these cases. I was curious to see what your thoughts and opinions were on that.
Steve, I have to agree with you. I absolutely have to agree with you, and I think it even goes beyond that. It's not just what's happening. I mean, I can give you just a very good example of that, or the main example I have is that if somebody is found to have what we call a final restraining order against them, or an FOP, a final order of protection, or whatever the states call, almost every state in the family system will order that person to go through some alternative to the domestic violence counseling, or ADV counseling they call it, or whatever type of counseling they're going to name it, because they deem that to be appropriate in that situation. All of those companies that do this sort of servicing are almost always private. And they are, the person who is the defendant in that case is required to take this program or they'll be held in contempt of a court's order. So they're actually, the power of our government is assisting private industry in this. It's not even a state-run program that they're saying you have to attend. You have to attend. Oftentimes, when the court sentences you and say, okay, you have to go to the ADV program, they might only have one or two that are on that list that are appropriate in the individual's particular county. And those one or two ADV programs might require that you go through 20 sessions or 30 sessions at a cost of $50, $175 a pop, whatever it is. And if you don't attend, then they're going to report back to the court that you haven't spent your extra $1,000 in their private program. And if I even took it a step further and were to even be a little bit more questioning as to the motivations, these private programs do donate politically. They absolutely are permitted to donate politically. They're absolutely permitted to give heavy donations. And some of that we know is profited off of people who are found to be either guilty of domestic violence, or something along those lines where an FOP might be issued against them.
Steve, I want to just throw in something personal from when I practiced family law. That what Shelley's talking about, there used to be a list of who those approved. And when I say approved, they were approved because they were politically connected or because of what Shelley said, they had contributed enough. The additional danger to everything Shelley just said was, if you represent the client and you show up in a courtroom and you've used an expert other than who they recommended, and I can even go to accountants, not just any kind of therapy or rehabilitative therapy for anger or for physical abuse. It could be expert witnesses as accountants or in any other field. The courts have favorites. They throw business their way. They encourage lawyers to use them. And sometimes when you use someone that isn't one of the favorites, you actually are coming in at a disadvantage, even if your expert is very good and done their work and are great on a stand. You still have annoyed the court. You have bucked the system. So that there is a lot of inherent it's like incestuous is a good word. The system is incestuous, and it favors its own. It financially benefits its own. And I guess it's another aspect, Steve, to what you're saying. You're talking about federal government matching funds. And I guess your point, Steve, goes to the issue of government growing itself constantly. This is one of the ways government grows itself. We all talk about how big government has gotten, and one of the big issues is particularly the federal government. I know the point you're making, Steve, about these federal funds isn't just in terms of supplementing or financing the court system. It works everywhere in the sense that government is just growing itself in every way it can, and this is one aspect of where we see government growing itself. Shelley, I'd like to also ask you, have you seen more of this, what I
what I'm perceiving to be more Fourth Amendment testing and pushing back against and violation of. Is it different than it was, say, 20 years ago? And if so, why do you think that is?
I think it is different. And I think it's different in that we changed and we've changed over time to a society that is less and less questioning the authority of the police. And I don't know if that's because we were the victims of such a horrible, horrible terrorist attack and we used it as a justification. We've all forgotten the words, I believe, of Jefferson it was, when we changed the protections that we harm society as a whole. It's a very difficult thing because we all want to perceive ourselves as being very, for lack of a better term, law and order. We all want to perceive ourselves as following the rules. I think when we're going to see the big change in this is when we see more and unfortunately more and more victims of this type of Fourth Amendment abuse that are really coming to the forefront to say, look, I am truly an innocent victim, and somebody knocked my door in and did this to me. And, you know, we have had examples of this, though, in New York City. I'm thinking of a woman who, you know, the police came in and she had a heart attack and died. And she did absolutely nothing wrong. There's a case of a small boy also in New York City where they literally firebombed the house. They put in the police threw in a smoke bomb of sorts. So I think when we see more and more of these things coming to light, hopefully there'll be something different. Now, I do have to say, though, and I really want to make this clear, too, there has to be a balance against the police. The police are not our enemies. They should not be our enemies. What we need to do is work with the police. I do think, and I've worked with the police on many occasions. In fact, I still work with police and with prosecutors' offices on many occasions. None of them are out there to get us. They really aren't. The good ones aren't looking at this is their bullying tactic. They have a very difficult job, and they have to make split-second decisions, and they are trained well. This isn't a matter of them not being trained and not knowing what they're doing in almost every single case. Granted, there's a few bad eggs, but they are a few. Most of them do not want to harass us or do anything of the sort to us. I think the issue really has to come down to more communication. And I don't know where that comes into play. I don't know if that comes into play that we should have the police more involved in communities. I don't know if that comes into play that we should have the police just, you know, the sensitivity training that they're doing. And I don't think that's the answer. I truly don't. But I don't think that they're out there to hurt us, and I don't want to chastise every single police department and every single police officer out there.
Steve, get in here on this, because I know, I have a feeling you take issue with what Shelley just said about the police, that they're good guys mostly and out to help us. Am I right?
Well, you know, let's be clear. I do think the police do serve a vital role, so I don't want to disparage all the police. But I would say it seems to me over the last, you know, 15 to 20 years, it seems there's been a markedly different change than the police force that we once grew up with. And I think, you know, one of the main issues that I do take issue with has been, it's been a function of kind of the two wars that we've had. And what's happened, it seems, in a lot of police forces, they're selling off a lot of these excess government materials to the police forces. So it's not uncommon now to see, you know, a police force that's much more militarized, has much more heavy gear, and, you know, in some ways I would say 9/11 has also taken, you know, the policing of America a lot more seriously, and I would say a lot more, in many ways, a lot more intrusive. So I would say, you know, I would say the difference has been, in my observations and everything that I read and everything that I've read over the last 10 years, is that the police force, for me, has always been a sense of they're there to enforce the law, and that's really their main function. And really what I think is, as with the difference that I notice now, and I can cite many different instances just personally, is that the police are now actively looking for people that are you know, intending to do crimes or want to do crime. It seems like it's a markedly, you know, different feeling, a different sensation that's taking place. And you know, I lived in New York City for many years, and I can tell you, pre 9/11, I was never stopped, and I've been stopped, I would say, 3 or 4 times, you know, for a variety of reasons. In New York City, they have the policy of, stop and frisk now, where they can actually stop, frisk you, check your bag, and see what you have in there. So I'd say those things didn't really exist 20 years ago, and I think there's a lot more instances that the police force has gotten much more aggressive, and I think there is a bit of a pushback now from the citizenry that they feel that the police is no longer really on our side as they once were.
The experts that I've listened to who talk about what can we do about this, if you live in a community where you feel the way Steve feels, or and often the way I feel about police departments and the change that's occurred, the experts that I've listened to say what we can actually do is on a very local level. That's the place to attack this, so that you go to your zoning board meetings, you go to the local meetings, you go to the council meetings. And for example, an expert that I listened to this morning said everyone in that town where that woman lives, who the incident in Kansas, they ought to be at the next meeting saying we do not want our police to behave that way. We do not want children and youth services to respond the way they did in this particular instance, assuming the facts that this child never said anything so inflammatory, which we still don't know. I haven't yet heard. So the point of this is people tend to feel helpless when it comes to military, when it comes to government, as if we are all the victims and at the mercy of. And it isn't true. Everything I hear from the people, and I'm talking about constitutional lawyers who've been doing this for 40 years, fighting First Amendment and Fourth Amendment violations or infringements, say get involved on a very, very local level. The more local, the better. The more chance you have to impact the way your local police force will act in a situation, even if it's contacted by an external police force or a more federal force, they will, if they understand how the community will respond to overreaching, they will be very careful. It's when we throw our hands up and we think that we're at the mercy of our two senators and our, you know, however many congresspersons we have, it is easy to feel powerless. It is. And so I guess I'm encouraging our listeners to, if you care enough, to get involved on a very local level. Once you do that, you not only do you not have to feel disempowered, you don't have to be someone who sits around saying, you know, well, that's the way it is. It doesn't have to be that way if you speak up and stand up for what you believe in. And there are infinite number of instances in history where one voice makes a difference. And there's always the possibility that you are that one voice, whoever you are, wherever you are. So, Steve, we've got about a minute. Is there anything you wanted to say in closing?
No, I'm fine. Thanks.
Okay, so we want to thank Shelley Albert for joining us here on tonight's show. It's always great to have someone who's in the trenches. Shelley, obviously, as a criminal defense attorney and former assistant district attorney in Manhattan, works with the police, brings that other perspective, and brings all those years of interactive experience, and we're always grateful. Thank you, Shelley, for joining us tonight on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Steve, I'll let you say goodnight for yourself.
Thank you. Good night, everybody.
And thanks for listening. We'll, of course, be back again on Monday evening at 6 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Eastern, Above the Fray podcast. Please remember to like us on our Facebook page, AboveTheFrayPodcast.com. Follow us on Blog Talk Radio. And where else, Steve?
Make sure you give us a positive review on iTunes to let us know how well we're doing with you guys.
There you go. And you can always contact us through our website, AboveTheFrayPodcast.com. Have a great weekend, everybody.
You've been listening to Above the Fray with Carol Gold and Steve Clark, from politics to the divine. Thanks for being a part of a new way to see the world. Visit our website at AboveTheFrayPodcast.com and like us on our Facebook fan page, Facebook.com/AboveTheFrayPodcast. This has been Carol Gold and Steve Clark, taking you always above the fray.